Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 4th, 2000. Tonight in the fireside room, we have a forum. This forum is on the reminiscences of former village members during their mining days. Let's listen in.
At the museum here, and my new assistant in the museum is Linda Jensen, and we're joined by Gary Baster. Both Linda and Gary lived here in Holden as kids during the mining days, and so the purpose of the program is just to let them talk a little bit about what life was like here in those days, and hear a little bit of their stories, provide you some chances to ask questions about their experience of the time here, and then we'll perhaps see a few slides of what the village was like in those days as well, but we'll play that part by ear. I'm here simply as a quasi-moderator to get things rolling, but it'll be Linda and Gary that provide most of the commentary. What I'd ask them to do, I guess, is just a little bit of basic family history. When were you here, and what ages for you or your siblings, and your parents and what they did here, and what life was like a little bit, just to kind of get us started and see some other questions from that. So maybe Gary, if you'd like to, to start.
I represent the 1940s here at Holden Village, and I'm a Depression baby. And the reason why I mention that is that to understand the setting of Holden in the 40s, you need to realize the mindset of the people who have come here. My dad was a young man in Buffalo, New York, and he had a friend, Sarge, who came to him. He was in the Army, and he said, "Now, Bud, I want you to go quit your job and join the CCCs, which was the Civilian Conservation Corps, and come with me. We're going to go to Idaho, and we're gonna tear up the place. So I want you to come with me." So Bud quit his job, and he came to Idaho with the CCCs, and there is where he met my mother, who was playing piano at the local dance. And they were married in Buffalo, but the Depression was still at its peak. And they came back to the Northwest, to Idaho, and my dad was a lumberjack and hurt his back, but was studying electricity. So he heard about this job at the Holden Mine for House Sound Company in the compressor room. What the compressor room was the way of distributing the electricity that came here into the camp. So in 1941, we came here, started school in about November of 41. And my sister was, Gloria, was born during that year. And we moved into a home up here in what we call the campsite. I had never heard of Winston before I came to Holden. So this was the town site, and that was the campsite. So most of my initial comments are just going to be about the aura of the Depression and what it meant to this village. And if you were to take some of these people nowadays and say that people came here for a vacation, it would be like you going across the railroad tracks to the mud flats. That was the concept, that this was one of the few places that they had to have their own home. They had three meals a day. They had were learning a community. They had a certain amount, there was a security here. And so they were being pushed out of the Depression and into the war years. Now, as a result of that, you had a certain mentality. You didn't think of this as necessarily a beautiful setting. It was just where you lived. And one of the things you really hated was going up on the Lady of the Lake. I mean, that was really a real drudge. You didn't think of it in terms of vacation. I guess my main comment was when I went back to the two-room schoolhouse, which is not two rooms anymore, but it was two rooms when I was there. I went from the first through the third grade with Mrs. Bowie, and the fourth through the first through fourth and fifth through eighth with Miss Fields. Florence Field was here as the principal and the teacher, still living. She's 95 years old out in Chelan and is a legend in her own time, even in Chelan. But when I went back, I was really amazed at how small the classes were. We had about 40 kids. And I told one group of kids that when I was there, you didn't daydream in the winter when you were going to school. You know why you didn't daydream? Because the snow came up to the eaves of the roof. You couldn't see out of anything. I never knew there was a short-handled shovel till I went to Wenatchee. It was always long. And one year, I don't know how we did it, we tunneled out of our house. Yeah, onto the roadway. Although the roadway was maintained quite well, so some of the modern machinery, if you ever go up here on the tailings area, you'll see a snow going. It's those large screws, looks like bit screws in the front of it, used to throw the snow out to the side. But to get back to the schoolhouse, it was a very small place, and you learned to read or else. That was just the fact of life. You learned your Rice penmanship and your math. And I, to this day, remember the map on the wall, United States map in the colors of the states. But that was the school setting. When you come back to Holden, you realize the change in concepts about education, that this is the classroom here. It's the surroundings. And I always say I'm embarrassed because I can't tell you anything about the flowers or the trees or the geology of this area, because we were the kids that went to school there. We had our own community of kids. And we did kid things. Now, when the 50s came around, the parents started getting involved with kids. It's kind of called like this. And they wouldn't let them go into the woods or across the street. And that was our playground. We would go up the little knoll and go down on the cardboard. And then we were on skis during the wintertime. We used to trap for rabbits with a copper wire in the winter, go down to fish. There's a fir tree that probably has a dilapidated rope. I used to climb and look over the village, and I was out all the time in the area. And we would get together as a community in the evening, playing kick the can or Red Rover or hide and go seek until late in the evening. And then pretty soon all of the mothers would come out on their porches and yell down the valley for the kids to come home. And that was our community up through the eighth grade, which was about 100 years old at the time that it even took place. Every one of us had problems when we went out into the world, just from that transition time. There was no intermediate. You kind of got pushed out into this world, and the adjustment was, this was a small town environment. You had, this is what life was, it revolved around the ebb and flow of the community.
My perspective's a little bit different. My family was actually involved somewhat with the mine even before I was born in 38 and 39, because my father managed Safeway in Chelan, so he shipped lots of groceries and things up here. And then my folks lived on the coast for a while, where I was born. And then in 1945, they returned to the Chelan area and operated the Chelan Falls Mercantile, a little grocery store down at Chelan Falls, between 1945 and 1950. And at that time, my father had lots of contacts up at Holden, because they shipped groceries to lots of families and knew a lot of the people that were up here, as well as knowing a lot of people in Chelan. When the lease was up on the store, they decided not to renew, like many mom-and-pop businesses, long hours. And so Dad came to work at the mine, in 1950. We lived in Chelan for a year waiting for a house to be available in Winston Camp because while the homes in the circle were assigned to management staff, we had to buy our homes and live up in a campsite where Gary and I lived, and so we had to wait for a house to be available to buy. And I came in 1951. I'm not a baby boomer, I'm a little bit too old for that. I was actually born during the war. But Gary and I were comparing notes today about some of the differences in rules being a little more strict in the 50s because the baby boomers were starting to hit school in 52, 53, and there were quite a few more kids. When I came, they were already into three rooms in 1951. And in 1953, they actually had to open up the basement, and the rooms were further segregated, so the big room, quote, was now 6th, 7th, and 8th instead of 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th because of the number of kids in school. So we had a little bit more strict rules, like we were never allowed to cross the creek go in the creek area without an adult, whereas these kids had a lot more free rein, and we had more organized activities. They had organized activities too, but I think we had even more in terms of parents keeping an eye, just because there were sheer larger volumes of very young children, because the first and second grades were growing. My father started as a mucker in the mine and then moved up. He actually operated the train. And my mother is one of the women that worked here. She was employed, and she worked in the Fountain Lunch, which in those days, in addition to the ice cream, there was a grill in there. They served steak dinners and hamburgers, and that was the restaurant where you went out to dinner. And there were also women employed up in the dining hall. And I don't know, some of them I think worked as cooks in the kitchen too, didn't they? But an interesting factor about that is even though these women worked in waitress type jobs, they were members of the miners' union and they received miners' wages, so they got very good pay in those days. And I went to school grades 4 through 7 here, and I know Gary and I were talking, in both the 40s and the 50s, one of the big parts of the school, and that involved also the village center or the rec hall, is we did all these programs and plays, these music. In fact, you said your mother was one of the music teachers, so she directed some of those programs. So we'd have we had a community Christmas tree every year. And every kid in town up through grade 8 got a present from Santa Claus, and there'd be music at the Christmas program. And then we'd do these operettas, these plays. They'd even bring costumes in, ship in for some of those plays. So we had a lot of exposure to those types of things. Also, I think in the 50s, maybe because they had a fewer number of grades, it sounds like we got a little bit more variety in our education curriculum. We still got the basics very well, but when I was in sixth grade, Mrs. Field had gone to a summer school program at the University of Washington, and then she came back and we actually had a woodshop block, which had not happened before, so that was kind of fun, like kids getting junior high. So there are some differences between the 40s and 50s in terms of things that we did. But in both eras, as he talked about, you know, the fun and the playing out in the community, you didn't have to worry about problems here. So it was a very safe place to be and a very family community. We had you guys had the picnics too at the ballpark during 4th of July and Labor Day weekend. They'd have big picnics that start in the morning, would be the kids' races and the women's nail driving and log sawing contests and the pie eating contests. And we'd have the huge feast at noon and food, and then in the afternoon the men would have softball competition. And they also had softball games during the summer, and teams would come in from outside to play. In the winter they had basketball teams come in to play in the gym. That's one of the reasons that gym was built, was such state of art. They also had big New Year's dances and the Eve dances in the gymnasium. That was adult activity. Very formal dances. The women dressed all up in dresses and high heels. The men wore suits. A band would come from Wenatchee. So that was their activity. We had movies 3 times a week in the 50s. Did you guys have them?
Yeah, I was thinking about the desecration since we've left, though. That first of all, they took down the basketball hoops in the center. And secondly, they put the prayer maze up in the baseball field. What do they call it?
Labyrinth. Yes.
What happened to the old values anyway?
It's changed. Well, and you also walk on that floor, which we never, we could not walk on that gym floor with street shoes. The only time we could go on it was when it was covered with the canvases. They had these huge canvases they covered it with for when we had movies or programs. And if you, I know people don't like to sit in them now because they're very old and rickety, but those chairs that are three connected, that's what we sat on. That was our movie seats and our program seats. So those are here from that those days. That's why they're kind of getting old and rickety. But and they folded up and went on these carts that slid. If you have ever lifted up the, there's panels on the front of the stage and lifted up, and those carts with those chairs on slid under the stage. So that was the big activity center. And then, of course, downstairs. Now, in the up into the early 50s until they were outlawed, they actually had slot machines downstairs, too. That's what funded all our Christmas presents. After the slot machines were outlawed, we started getting applets and collets instead of toys. The community club was running out of funds. But again, I think we like to emphasize the fact that it was such a fun community place and a place that, much like today, there's I see so many parallels because it was a close-knit community. We were just as isolated. We had one thing over you, though. We had power from the outside, so you guys didn't have that luxury. But otherwise, we were like you. We were very isolated. Medical emergencies were even worse in those days because there were no helicopters to come in. I mean, it was down the road and down lake by boat if there were medical emergencies. So, but again, very tight-knit community and very supportive.
I was thinking about coming back to Holden and the emphases that is here, and I'd just like to talk a little bit about that. One is the spiritual aspect of it. It was like there was no spirit here as far as a Christian witness. It was the company was very adamant that no organized religion would come in and establish anything. I think once a month when I was growing up, we had an Episcopalian minister that came in once a month, had kind of a quasi Sunday school. And then I remember a Baptist minister that came in and scared the hell out of Johnny Curzon and me one summer. That was about the extent of the religious influence. The other was in the arts. And I'm thinking about music, art, and dance. Our music came from the Golden Songbook. Do any of you remember the Golden Songbook? So the long, long trail of winding and Old Black Joe is what I remember most of. The Rogers twins used to sing, we used to sing one song called Ring, Ring the Banjo, I Love That Good Old Song. And my mother would be singing, would play on the piano because she was the music teacher that would come into the school. And the Rogers twins would say, Ring, Ring the Banjo, I hate that stinking old song. Now, aside from that, the only music I was aware of was my mother played for a quartet called the Howie Sounders. And it was actually very, very good. And I remember White Christmas is one of the distinctive songs. So that was our music. And I can never remember any art here in the community. I was never aware of any, except maybe crayons between the lines and you better not screw up type of art. I mean, that was about it. And I just don't remember any pictures or a little bit of photography with tinted pictures. There was one woman who tinted pictures, but that was about it with the art. And then the dance. It was interesting to come here and see the dance and adapt it to spiritual modes. Well, dance to us meant New Year's Eve. And most of the miners are drunk on their face. I mean, it was the booze came up from Lucerne. I mean, it was the time when all the bars were down. That in the 4th of July. So your vision of, her vision of the dance hall with the women dressed up was a little bit different from our vision. Bull Adams, you know, he hardly could keep his eyes open, stomping around the dance floor. And to mention about Bull Adams, his son Nigel is one who has been a great historian of this era. And you can pick up his book and read about him. The interesting thing about him was that in his slant, he tried to make it management against labor. And he was trying to build his doctoral thesis on that. Well, that made Jack Curzon, who was the manager at the mine, pretty unhappy with him, because this was quite an enlightened organization. The time when they didn't really mess up was when they left and they just closed down the camp, and the copper prices went down, and then out the door, the company left, and people just scrambled to get out, and then particularly to get jobs somewhere else. But for the most part, it was an enlightened environment. The communists came in the early 40s and tried to convince the workers that they were being downtrodden, and they got laughed out of the community. But the arts and the spiritual were real missing elements of the 40s, because people were still in the survival mode, and it was quite interesting to see God reclaiming the valley, in a sense, with the activity that's here now.
And some of that changed a little bit in the 50s, although the company policy about not having a specific religion come in and organize was maintained. We did have a gentleman working here who had, I think he'd actually dropped out of seminary for a while and did go back later. He was working in the carpenter shop, so he held some basic, he was allowed to hold some basic non-denominational, just very basic Christian services in Sunday school, but, you know, they weren't, there were not rituals or anything like that. It was just basic. We did some singing, we had a basic sermon, and we had some Sunday school classes, and that was it. But he was allowed to do that in the 50s. I'm laughing when you mention the art. The only art I remember is painting scenery for plays. We on paper, poster paper, or flats that we painted. But in the 50s, we did have a music teacher, or one of the mothers, that taught us. We were having got square dancing and some folk dancing class that we taught as PE classes during the winter. So we got to do some of that.
And yeah, you got some health education too.
Yeah, we got maybe, we did a little bit, a little teeny bit, not very much, and we got a little bit of science. He said they didn't get any science or health. They got the reading, writing, arithmetic. We got a little bit of health and science by the 50s too. Again, of course, the class sizes were, there were fewer number of classes, and so I guess they were picking up more curriculum. As far as I'm concerned, our education was absolutely superb. The first year after I left here, I spent the whole year in school sitting like this, thinking, yeah, I know that. Yeah, I learned that last year. I learned that 2 years ago. I was pretty far ahead in most of my subjects when I left here. So we did get a very good education. It was intense.
I think the individuals, people, always make up a community in your background. I was just thinking, in fact, I hadn't asked Linda whether she knew Push 'Em Up. Did you know Push 'Em Up?
No.
Push 'Em Up was a ditch digger, and his philosophy was, if you're going to be a ditch digger, you're going to be the best ditch digger there ever was. And he was an Eastern European. I even forgot his name, but he was a man. He could wield a shovel like unbelievable. And then we were talking about Auntie, Folk, and George. They were an elderly couple, and George had come here to work in the mine, but was actually a professional gambler. And he would fleece the guys down here in the hall, because there was unlimited gambling down here in the hall. And Auntie Folk was this eccentric woman who had a house full of cats. And you'd walk in there and just get knocked over by cat smell. And eventually when she left, and she was a very very naive person. If you were to suggest that George was a professional gambler or a gambler of any kind, she'd be shocked. Not her husband, George. Apparently she left, when she left the cat. And they pretty well died off or became wild. But the characters in this community stand out to me because in such a small confines, you get to know people pretty well. In fact, you had to behave yourself in the village because everybody knew about it. It was such a small community. I think that the rhythms of the season meant quite a bit to me too, which you always knew that it was going to snow on Halloween night. You'd go out for trick-or-treating and here was the snow. And of course the Christmas time and the perplexity, there could be quite a sociological division between the town site and the campsite. And the greatest division that I saw was the fact that most of these people had brick chimneys big enough for Santa Claus. And I only had this little metal from an oil stove, you know, chimney, and never figured out how you'd come down. And of course, the 4th of July was always big, and they would bring in teams from the Air Force or Army and just absolutely whip us to death. One of the character stories, though, was included my dad, who was a boxer, and in fact, he that's how he left the village. He and Joe Short used to cuss each other out. Joe was the blacksmith at the mine. My dad had come in, worked in the compressing room, and then eventually was a diamond driller because there was more money. So they'd cuss each other out in the mine. One day Joe said, "Oh, you're good." My dad went over and just knocked him out. So he had a choice to either be fired or to leave, and that pretty well ended his career here at Holden. Although we stayed because I had one more year to go. And the other story is involving my dad was there was a manager here by the name of John Bly. And John was a big guy, and he played football at Washington State. And those were two guys that you didn't mess with. And one day they squared off. They didn't fight, but they just started to square off. And Johnny Curzon, whose dad was the manager, he said, "You know something? When those two guys squared off, the earth stood still."
I'd like to mention, you know, his comments about the 40s and the New Year's and the drunken now. One of the things I remember about the 50s is, and it goes back to his comment about his father had a choice of leaving because of the, you know, hitting the guy. They didn't put up with any nonsense. And also, the alcohol was very controlled because even at New Year's, all the parties were held in the homes and there was plenty of partying going on, but they never allowed it to be served down in the rec hall area. And it was not served in public. But if they wanted alcohol, they had to go to the tavern at Lucerne. And I think it was that way in the 40s too, wasn't it, Gary?
By the time they got the dance hall, there wasn't anything external, but it was all pretty internal.
Yeah, that's true. But they did, again, it was a very environment in terms of they didn't have any problem people up here because they just, you know, if there was problems, they were gone. And I'm going to share another character story because some of the characters that live here make it. Gary and I talked about the bazaars that were held in the fall. The women had activities. They had birthday clubs and bridge clubs, but they also had hospital guilds, and they raised money for Orthopedic Hospital, which is now Children's Hospital in Seattle. And then when the Chelan Hospital was built, they raised money for Chelan Hospital. And they did other things during the year, but the big thing was the bazaar in the fall. And they would had cookbooks, and they did. There was booths selling different things, and the Boy Scouts and the Campfire Girls had things to sell to raise money, and there was fish pond games. But they also had these wonderful raffles, and they had different things to raffle off. In the 1950s when I was here, and I don't remember if it was 52 or 53, but they had this beautiful, beautiful toboggan that they were was one of the raffles for the bazaar. And as kids, if you were below high school age, then you babysat. That's how you made all your money. During the summer, the high school kids were all given jobs by the company. So the babysitters were all the eighth grade and below. And we were spending all our money buying all these tickets to win this toboggan. And when the drawing was held that night, the winner was a lady whose name was Chubby. And there was a reason her name was Chubby. And she won that toboggan. She had no kids, and she took the toboggan and kept it. And we were just heartbroken about that. So we never got to play with it or enjoy that beautiful toboggan. And again, that's another example, though, I think about your community activities, because those women actually did raise a lot of money over the years for the hospitals. And there is a cookbook up in the museum that one of the women had donated. I know the museum's closed now, which is sad, because there are a lot of nice things up there, but there is one of the cookbooks that they made from 1947, I think it is, or 48. So again, there were those type of activities. Besides the social activities, there were charitable. In many ways, I think, especially in the early 50s, this community was much like any other community in America, except it was very isolated, and maybe even more small town and closer than others, because we depended on each other. Gary and I were both commenting about there were tragedies when we were up here. Besides people dying in the Mun, there were two children died when you were up here. The one on
one on Bonanza, and then one at drowned in Lake Chelan.
When I was here in the 50s, we had a young boy that drowned in the creek. He and a neighbor, he'd gone fishing with a neighbor and his daughter, and the neighbor took his daughter across the creek, and Tony was supposed to wait for the neighbor to come back and get him, and Tony started across on his own and fell off the log and went in the creek. And then we did have a polio scare here in 1953, which was pretty horrendous, being so isolated, and there was one family stricken, and the oldest daughter did die. They were taken to Wenatchee, but the oldest daughter died, and that was pretty hard on the family. So those, but the community was very supportive of that. Also, my father died while we were here. He came home from off swing shift and dropped dead of a heart attack. And the community support for families in those situations was just incredible. And there was another family who the father drowned in Lake Chelan fishing. When my mother moved in the summer after my dad died, she said, I wasn't here on moving day because I was young enough that I was sent ahead to my grandparents kind of to be out of the way. But she talks about when her brothers came with the truck to bring her, to load up our goods. She said the barge came in and they brought the truck up, and when they were backing it up to the house, she heard this hooping and hollering. And I mentioned she'd worked in the Fountain Lunch, so she knew a lot of the single guys in the dorms because they'd come in there for meals and stuff. Not only were there many neighbors there to help her, but she said, here come this group of about 10 guys with a couple cases of beer, and she never lifted one piece of furniture that day. She never loaded a thing on that truck. Everything was done for her. And to tell you how well they packed that truck when it was unloaded in Marysville, it was a half bottle of beer unspilled in the front end of the truck. But that's the type of community support it was for people. And medical things like that were very hard because it was down Lake in a hurry.
So. One of the things that I'd recommend is that you go on the tour with Linda. It takes you from the town site to the campsite. I learned more about Holden just with her in about 15 minutes than I did in living here for 8 years, so I'd recommend that. Why don't we open it up for questions, and maybe we can kind of spin off of it.
What was the population? What was the size?
I think about 600 people were the most that were here.
Yeah, it maxed out at about 600. The school was actually up to over 100 kids by the time it closed. But when you were here, would you say probably about 40 kids?
About 40.
40 kids, so.
Did the company manage the social system, or was there any other kind of form of town council or anything like that here?
Well, you didn't have a town council because it was a company town, so everything in town was owned by the company and run by the company. The school board was independent. they were elected members, because my dad was elected to the school board, and he wasn't, you know, he wasn't a management type in the mine. He was a working person, but he was on the school board for a couple of years.
But, so basically, the company then dealt with any social issue, whether it's kicking someone out for misbehavior or...
There was no court.
There was no court because you worked for the company, and if you weren't behaving, you were fired. And if you had no job, you couldn't stay here because you were only here if you were employed.
But Linda, you mentioned the union, but was there a union when you were here in the 50s, and was there a union in the 40s, or did that change?
There was a union.
Well, there was a union.
There was a union. But the relationship was good.
Okay.
And I think if you were on my walk, I'd mentioned that
I didn't.
Oh. There was a union, and but they had a very good relationship. When we were here in the 50s, there was actually a strike, and the miners were very unhappy about that strike. But the reason there was a strike was because there were the union was negotiating with three companies at a time, us and one in Montana, and I think one in Idaho. And the Montana and Idaho companies were not making as good an offer as Howe Sound was, and so those union guys went on strike, and they outnumbered our union guys. So we were on strike for a while, and they were very unhappy about it because we really had a very good offer. So that situation, I know there was another strike. I've read, there's articles up in the museum. There was a short strike sometime in the 40s too, but I don't think it lasted long, because when you come back to the reunions, and I, as a child, like Gary said, we didn't know much about this stuff, but when you come back and I've learned, and listening to some of these guys talk, you realize that how modern of an operation this was. Many of their management styles, they would use anybody's ideas. So, you know, I don't think it was as divisive probably as a lot of other places. And even, they laugh about, you know, they lived in the circle and they lived up there. But the kids played together, and you know, the groups, there was a lot of interaction. So I don't think you felt the social class stigmas much, other than, you know, they were probably had more New Year's Eve parties here than we did up in, not as much, and not a lot of labor management type chaos compared to other places.
Melissa?
Along the same lines, was everybody white who was here? Like, class?
Probably like a lot of other small towns in this area, we were fairly... I am aware in the 50s there was a couple of Hispanic, we called them Mexican then, brothers that worked here that were really nice. One of them was a real character. His name was Max, and my mother just adored him. He was a single guy, and he used to come into the fountain lunch, and he came in one time. He'd been to Lucerne, and he was feeling no pain. And... we had a lot of flowers up here. Women had flowers. Pansies grew practically wild, and you see the iris. Mother picked a big bouquet of pansies and had it on the counter in the fountain, and after he got his steak, he took all the pansies and tore them up and put them on his steak and ate them. So he was another character. But, you know, I will have to say I don't remember ever seeing any black miners up here.
We didn't even know what a black person was.
I don't know.
I guess in this part of the country in general, at that time, it was pretty...
Well, you could have trouble if you brought a black person up here because of the socioeconomic
problems. In fact, I was thinking last night when I was sitting here, if any of you saw the program last night, you know, the kind of the lead engineer is Jennifer. See, now in our day, when you're up here, things were so superstitious, women would never have been allowed in the mine.
Yeah. Of course, you don't see a lot of blacks up here now either. Notice that, Linda?
Yeah, you don't see too many. It's an isolation.
Most Lutherans, you know. I mean, it takes them a while.
But I think the isolation was a lot of it. Just it was a very, very small town.
Yeah, I just wondered whether it was like that they would have people of color who would, you know, serve food or things like that, if it was kind of a...
No.
Well, I'm sure that just wasn't allowed.
Did you have cars up here?
Yes, we did during the summer. During the winter, you couldn't keep a car unless you had a garage, and very few houses. You guys had a garage.
We didn't have a car. We didn't have a telephone either.
No. No, the only telephones were in management houses, some shift supervisors, and then as I talk about on my mine walk, there's one location up in the middle of Miners Village. There was one in a couple of places where there were boxes with phones in the corner, so there was always a phone in any reasonable block area in case of emergency that you could go.
You could call outside?
Absolutely not. You could. Yes, you could call on a Forest Service line to the office in Chelan, but that is all. It was not a direct line. It was a little, pardon me, I'm an ex-telephone person, but it was a magneto ring-down type phone system. The switchboard was this big. And I believe the switchboard, if any of you want to look, stop and look, I think it's there. I think the switchboard's in the Rocky Reach Museum at Rocky Reach Dam on Highway 97. But they did have the ring-down phone. But that did not go to the outside world at all. So no telephone.
Radio contact.
No.
How about a gas station? Was that a gas station?
No. No, we had to get gas from the company. Oh, and then I was going to get back to the cars during the winter because of the snow equipment on the road. You couldn't keep your car here, so most of them, people that had cars, parked them down at Lucerne near where the dock is today. And where the boat dock is, by the way, the original, that's where the mine dock was in that time. It was a different dock than the ones there now. But so they park the cars all over there at the side and disconnect the batteries and leave them there for the winter and bring them back up during the summer. So you could use them to go down to Lucerne for swimming, beer, or picnics. And
LB, what was the population of Lucerne during this time?
Well, I don't know. It wasn't real big. It was
just enough to run a tavern.
Run a tavern, and the there were cabins down there that some mining people lived in, but they were also resort cabins during the summer. That there were Oscar Getty, who was a character in himself.
Yeah.
Now that's a history that was a whole another 2-hour session, but. He had a few cabins that he rented out for a resort and that, so it was pretty small.
But they weren't considered part of this village.
In the 40s, there were probably more miners living down there. By the time we were here in the 50s, there were very few of the mining people because they built enough homes up here. In fact, Gary and I were talking today when we did the walk. His house was actually right at the very end of where it was until the 50s, and then they had built the additional homes called the New Addition. And those are the ones that apparently weren't as well built. They were the first ones to go the first winter, the first ones to collapse. So Lucerne was pretty much separate at that time.
Now we have the modern ships on the lakes which do the traffic. What was this? Traffic in the olden days, what kind of steamers did you have here?
The tug and the barge were the big connection.
And then there was a lady, there was a lady of the lake, too.
A lady of the lake.
Was it a steamship?
No, it was a diesel.
Was it a diesel?
It was, if you think the lady too is slow, you should have taken the lady. Like he said, it was never a pleasure trip for us. It was during the winter, they'd run the speedway, which was a little bit smaller than the lady and a little bit faster. But they were both very, very slow boats. And then there really wasn't near as much traffic because there were not near the number of, you know, there's homes and different cabins and stuff a lot built along the lake now. In those days, there were very, very few. And it wasn't National Park yet. You know, it was still, Stehekin was all private at that time. So.
What memories do you have of Huntington Heights? What was there?
I just remember that a close friend of ours lived up there for a while, and it was somewhat of a pecking order at that time, too, that you know, from Honeymoon Heights, then as you progressed, then you came down here to the circle. So very, very limited memories of just some friends that lived up there.
My memories are picking up black caps because that's where the berries were, because in the 50s, well, they abandoned those buildings pretty early. And as I was mentioning on our walk, a lot of the homes that were up there were really, they kind of just did a little additional construction on some of the cabins that had been built during the 20s and 30s when they were, different companies were in here prospecting and working to develop the mine. There were buildings, and that was where the original families lived, and it's called Honeymoon Heights because many of them actually were bride and groom. We've had several of them back on our reunions. But it was so unstable with the mine operation and the avalanche chute above that they abandoned it pretty early on.
Do you remember many cabins up there? Do you remember them?
I only remember going, you know, when we picked berries up there, seeing remains of a few. There were not a lot. I do know that as recently as, I think, 4 years ago when we were up at one of the reunions, we could still find a little bit of the remnants of J.H. Holden's original cabin that he built when he was prospecting.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you could share what women did that was
praying. They prayed a lot. Well, one of the things I mentioned to Linda, and it's probably different in the 40s, but we had what we called a horse doctor. And a horse doctor was a relative of somebody who was an alcoholic and didn't do anything except in name. So when I broke my collarbone, I had to go down to Lucerne, get on the boat, go down to Chelan, and have my collarbone set. So it was there were some real disadvantages here at that time. But she has a few other stories to tell.
When we came here in 1951, the doctor that was here at the time also did not deliver babies. So at that time, they had to try to pretty much go out somewhere, you know, hopefully enough ahead that there wouldn't be problems. I think he came 52 or 53, then a doctor came that did deliver babies. In fact, I was talking to a gal the other day that's here and said that she had worked in Seattle with a gal that was born here, and she knew her first name, and I immediately told her what her last name was because her older sister was a good friend of mine. So in the 50s, there was a couple of doctors in here that did, and there's going to be one of the families coming. He talked about the Rogers twin. We are having a miners' reunion the first weekend after Labor Day here, and one of the Rogers of the 12 kids, there are five remaining, and they're all coming. And their youngest daughter, her daughter was the last baby born here in Holden. So, and those two girls are coming. So there were babies born here in the 50s.
Linda, up here.
Up there.
I was really surprised when you said that you had to buy the house. So can you say what happened when the bottom fell out of the market? Did everybody just lose?
You lost what you had in your house. You had 3 years. We bought our houses, but they were cheap. And we knew when we bought them that if the mine closed, you knew that you were going to lose it. You also, like this land, it's Forest Service land. You know, we paid $5 or something a year to the Forest Service for the land. But we had 3 years of that we had salvage rights to get whatever we wanted. And there were some families that actually dismantled their homes and trucked them out of here and barged them out. At the end of 3 years, and by that time they had been, by the time the gift to the Lutherans was being made, they had not yet destroyed the homes. So those of us that still had homes here, and even though we'd left earlier, we still had the ownership of our home because we had the majority ownership in it. We were given, we were sent letters and asked if we wanted to donate them to the Lutherans, and many of us did because we had nowhere with all to come. So we gave them the rights to take anything they could use out of our homes. And then in the summer of either 60 or 61, I'm not sure, spring, excuse me, when there was still about 2 to 3 feet of snow, in fact, my brother-in-law was on the crew that came in. They came in and burned them all, and then kind of bulldozed to try to put it back natural. But if you've walked up through there, you can see, you know, there's still a lot of steps and rock walls and places left. In fact, we were pointing out today, I can't really tell you where I live, except that I can show you where it is because it's under the septic field, but Gary was showing us where his home site was. So you can still find a lot of the traces of the home sites up there. But we basically, yeah, we lost them. And so people took tax write-off and donated them to the Lutherans.
Yes.
Is there a cemetery around here?
No, because this is Forest Service land. So people were, any deaths, the people were outside. In fact, there's quite a few of them in the Chelan Cemetery. I was commenting to Gary, my parents and the people who live next door to us here are buried side by side in Chelan. And just down the way is the general manager and his wife are, and another one of the circle people that we knew real well are that. So there's, they, most of them, a lot of them are in Chelan and Wenatchee.
Okay.
but none of this, because again, it's Forest Service land.
Melissa, you had a question.
Yeah, I know a lot of the hiking trails were here back during the mining days. People, you know, go to Hartley, you know, fishing, or go to use any of the other trails that we use now.
Once again, emphasizing, I guess, three things: the depression, the war, and the hard work. That is a whole different mindset. My recollection was that very few times I went out with my dad, but the people down here in management took advantage of the skiing and the hiking more than the campsite people, because it was hard work, and a lot of the trails have been built since the Lutherans have come.
When we were here in the 50s, Hart Lake and Holden Lake and Lyman Lake were areas that were gone too, but they were still, even in the 50s, were still working pretty long. I was trying to think. I think by the mid 50s, no, 53, 54, they were starting to go back to maybe only working a 5-day week instead of a 6-day week, because when you guys were here, I'm sure they were still working 6-day weeks, yeah, weren't they? So there was more time. So they did do a lot of fishing at Hart Lake and Holden Lake and to the Lyman and Cloudy Pass area, but not too much beyond that.
Would people go camping?
Well, they went backpacking, but and so the Boy Scouts went on, you know, these long treks and that. But if you think about in those days, you guys probably can't relate, but you know, food was only in cans. Your sleeping bags weighed, they were made out of canvas, you know how heavy canvas is. Your Trapper Nelson backpacks were wood. Your equipment was heavy, so that it wasn't as much as it is today. There was some, definitely, but not near to the extent, because like you said, it was long hours and hard work and family. Most of people coming here now are coming here for the recreation purposes, and we just lived here. Because Wes was just smart enough to be persistent, in my opinion. I think when, you know, they initially tried to sell it, and there's some history, and I've learned more of this because of working in the museum and getting the history. They tried to sell it. They tried to sell the area, you know, get a resort, different things going here. In fact, there's one article up at the museum that said, you know, this whole resort is, you know, the deal is final. And then 2 days later it says, the deal fell through. And I thought, sounds like typical newspaper. But I think it's just that there was nothing else to do with it anyway. They probably got a tax write-off for giving it. And aren't we blessed that they did? But I think, personally, a lot of credit goes to Wes and his persistence, too. I need to watch it.
Yes.
Gary, can you talk a little bit more about the struggles that you faced when you left Holden and went to the outside?
Oh, I think it was more of a social type of thing, where here you were, where you everybody played together, and then when you got to Wenatchee, you had, instead of 7 kids in your class, which was a large class, you had 250. I'd have to ask the shop teacher every day how to get to my English class. And some kids had, I remember my close friend of mine had a 48 Chevrolet convertible. We went to a dance, you know. It was a real culture shock. And so the ones that I knew, in our era, all had a lot of difficulty just adjusting from a community that was 100 years, in a sense, a society 100 years old, going into the mid 20th century, where things were really starting to pop. But it wasn't anything personal.
Even in the 50s, the high school kids talked about that too, the shock of going from such an isolated, controlled environment to just these huge, and some of them did have to go to places where they were very big high schools and huge classes, and it was overwhelming. Actually, even myself, when we left here, my first year, I was in a junior high school. I was absolutely terrified for probably half the year, and I relate to your comment, because we had to change classes. It's pretty overwhelming.
Do you have time for being Pardon?
Do you have time to see
the slide? Well, I show 6 o'clock, and I feel bad because we should. I would encourage if any of you are still here when the museum's open, do come up. We didn't. The slides are kind of a mix of some old and then some taken even after I did that are in color, and they show different pictures of the family. And some of the slides are actually some of the pictures that were taken by the Lutherans after they came. But
why don't we talk to Rick and see if maybe he can schedule it this weekend or something just for the slideshow?
Yeah, I don't know. If there's a possibility, I wouldn't mind doing that again. I didn't realize the time had gone that quickly. It usually does when we start talking. And people, you always ask good questions, which is what makes it so much fun to do this sort of thing. And thank you all.
Thank you.